I'd like to move along, sort of, again, keeping a clinical focus, but trying to make a transition, in some sense, to some of the other topics that are going to be discussed in the course of the week. And particularly, I'm going to try to balance between giving an overview of sort of a clinician's perspective, wearing my clinician hat, as well as some wearing my researcher hat, some, I think, of some of the active areas that are ongoing. I'll sort of sprinkle in here for the students, probably a few PhD theses, topics, hopefully along the way to give you some ideas. So first, just to give you a picture of where we're going to go, and talk a little bit about heart disease. Nat's already given you a nice introduction to that, but again, perhaps a little reinforcement won't hurt for those who are not clinicians in terms of their daily life. Then talk in particular then about some of the imaging approaches. Again, Nat's given me some ideas of that, as well as, again, following on his idea, some of the limitations of conventional imaging methods. Now, as was indicated, a lot of my own personal work has to do with the development of tagged MRI methods, so I'll focus on some of those examples. This is not going to be talk about tagged MRI per se. And then, since the theme of the meeting is all about modeling and where it can contribute, I'll try to give some ideas of where modeling can really fit in to try to address some of the current limitations of our methods. So first, heart disease. As I'm sure you all are well aware, it really is the most important disease, both in terms of morbidity and mortality, in the developed world. And increasingly, that includes McDonald's proliferating everywhere and smoking and all those other sorts of things, is becoming pretty ubiquitous as infectious disease is under control. And a common manifestation of heart disease is heart function that gets altered, and a variety of indicators, whether it's still poor exercise tolerance or other Frank's symptoms of failure and so on. These indications of alterations in function are really quite unreliable if you're just looking at symptoms. Patients can come in, you know, with, when we see patients walking around, measure the ejection fraction, even if you get a good number of the ejection fraction, somebody has an ejection fraction of 35, and they're up and they're walking around and they're really doing pretty well. And someone also have an ejection fraction, which is, you know, maybe 55%, and yet they're having symptoms, they're, you know, whether it's a diastolic dysfunction or whatever. We can have measures of dysfunction which are not necessarily congruent to very as much as we'd like with the actual patient's condition. So what we'd like to be able to do is to detect alterations in function. And we detect them earlier, detect them more precisely. And this is useful both for diagnosis, so we can find that someone has a problem and start treating it, as well as for getting more effective therapy. So if we could follow not just the symptoms, but in more effective ways of that indicated, of seeing, is this the proper drug to be using in this particular patient? It would be, I think, of great benefit. Now, people often come to us for getting their hearts evaluated, not just because they're going to have heart treatment, is this going to, the patient need a bypass or something, but because they're going to have to go other surgery. And obviously, they have a failing heart that puts you at much greater risk for an operation for something that's not directly cardiac related. And so cardiac function measurements are indicated not just for the heart disease alone, but also for other intercurrent problems. Now, as was indicated, there are a lot of different ways of trying to approach assessment of cardiac function with imaging. We've heard about some of the different projection methods, as well as tomographic methods. I'll talk in a minute more about that. And then, given imaging derived data, we now try to make various measurements of the function, both globally, as the infamous ejection fractions we're talking about, as well as local measures. And many diseases of the heart affect the heart non-uniformly, so it's important to be able to characterize regional function. As well, there are measures of regional function, which even though the heart's affected in a global way, give us more potentially precise ways of characterizing function. And then finally, the issue is, what do we do with all this data we generate, particularly with regional measurements of function? How do you then display that? An ejection fraction is easy, you know, it's 35%, that's a number. You start talking about things distributed within the heart and the highly complex things like tensors of strain, it's not simple. How do you decide to visualize that? Well, let's drill down and start looking at some of those cardiac imaging methods in a little bit more detail. Historically, what people used to do was fluoroscopy. And fluoroscopy, you know, puts putty in front of an x-ray, and in the old days, just a fluorescent screen, and then that would get replaced with sort of intensifier enhanced imaging. Really, you can see the heart and beats on that shadow. But it's really very limited. All you see is this blob, which is getting a little bigger and smaller. And it was really the big advance was the cardiac catheterization, as Nat said, we can inject radiopaque material into the cavity of the left ventricle and make a picture of that as it goes through the cardiac cycle. But of course, that's very invasive, with the benefit of being able to measure pressures, which is very nice, but it really is very limited still. against projection imaging, which has a lot of intrinsic limitations. With radionuclide imaging, particularly the so-called MUGA scan, we were able to get actually surprisingly good numbers, particularly for the ejection fractions, but not absolute measurements of volumes as we're talking about just recently. And again, relatively low resolution, but you know, clinically useful measurements. Now imaging has gone increasingly to tomographic imaging of various sorts. Now, echocardiography is very widely used. Most echocardiographers probably even have their own echo machine or one right down the hall. And with conventional echocardiography, there's limits, though. The images themselves are not spatially registered. You know, as Matt indicated, there's a lot of move towards three-dimensional imaging, requiring a volume rather than serial splices. But there are trade-offs in the signal, not a signal noise, particularly resolution. Particularly, you take a hit, take a lot of data at a certain amount of time. There's no free lunch; it has to come out of something else, and so the image quality takes a bit of suffering. And current methods, though, are really just focusing on serial, sort of freehand, two-dimensional imaging, and though in real time. MRI, I'm sort of proud to think it's very promising, but it's still not had a big clinical impact, and for a variety of reasons, which we needn't have to discuss in this particular context. But I think the promise is there that it'll contribute significantly to evaluation of heart patients, but it still has a ways to go before it has wider clinical acceptance. Radionuclide imaging, and you'll hear more about this later this week, is again very widely used, particularly for imaging of distribution of radiotracers which indicate local perfusion. In the course of doing this imaging, we get images of the heart wall. Since it's imaged in a gated way, we can make movies of the beating heart, albeit at very low resolution. And those are also, however, you know, quite though crude, a clinically useful indication of regional function. Computed tomography, which has been around a long time, and with earlier sort of experimental techniques like the dynamic spatial reconstructor project at the Mayo, people are doing these sort of relatively high resolution, high temporal resolution imaging. But there was never a practical project, but the real advances in spiral and multi-detector CT scanning in the past few years have led to greatly renewed interest in imaging of the heart with CT. Again, as Nat mentioned, the temporal resolution is still not quite there to really get sharp images through the cardiac cycle. But we do get very high resolution. If we look at relatively quiescent phases of the cardiac cycle, we can really get surprisingly good images. Now, this is just a representative sort of current state-of-the-art, not particularly unusually good image of an MR. This is in a short-axis plane. So we see here the left ventricle, the right ventricle, a little bit of the normal line of fluid here, then sitting the anterior chest wall, the left lung here, diaphragm. You can see here inferior vena cava, the descending aorta heading down below the diaphragm, sort of oblique plane section about this. So now we can see that there's a lot of information clearly in here. And as that said, an experienced observer will say, just looks like normal ejection fraction, normal function, and get a couple of that can move on. But there's a lot more information in here, potentially. When we try to measure the function, we can say, well, the wall's thickening here. We can measure that thickening. We can measure that radially around. You can try to draw a little line in here. Again, that should. You can, for example, make measurements end diastole, the biggest phase, and then systole, the smallest phase of the heart, and see what the difference is, and stack that up with a stack of coins, get volumes out. But they say, exactly where is the endocardium? We had sort of a rough structure in here. And the closer you look, the less obvious the answer is to that question. Is this blob in here and over here, the papillary muscles? You know, do you include those in the cavity or in the wall? And as it goes through the cardiac cycle, it seems to be well separated. It starts to merge with the wall. So where is the boundary there? And so these questions are not so simple. And the right ventricle is a thin wall to begin with, but again has at least as high or higher level of roughness. And we'll talk a bit more about that as we go. So what looks great is not quite so simple. Also, this, you know, looks like the heart wall, say it's the heart wall. Where actually are things moving within the heart wall? So this is a gray ring. It's really featureless. There's a lot of structure in here. We infer, for example, there's rotational components. It's like a little torsing and bouncing around different parts of the cardiac cycle. But we really can't see what's happening inside the wall. There's no intrinsic structure we can follow at this level. Well, cardiac function analysis has really focused primarily on these sort of global function measures in the past. Particularly, we can measure the volumes instead of stacking up cross-sectional areas, multiplying by the slice thickness, and doing a simple kind of trapezoidal rule integration. And most commonly in the clinical condition called Simpson's rule, I think it's really trapezoidal rule for mathematicians. In any case, we can then get the stroke volume by the difference of the end diastole and end systolic volumes. We can calculate wall volumes by the difference of the inside and the outside, for example, and the ejection fraction, just the ratio of the stroke volume to the end-diastolic volume, which, as has been pointed out, is a very crude but still clinically useful measure. Now, when we start trying to measure things a little bit more, we can say, well, we can look around at local function. And as you saw looking at those images, you can say, well, the heart's moving well here, and that looks like it's good all around. And, but this is really mostly qualitative. Either it's moving normally, it's moving, but sort of suboptimally, it's just sort of sitting and not moving, it's even bulging out in the wrong direction during systole, sort of a dyskinetic. And kind of that kind of qualitative grading is not all that you usually use. You can try to get more quantitative, as I mentioned, measure wall thickening. But again, we're subject to uncertainties exactly where is the wall, and we'll come to some other uncertainties. So these are conventionally used, but have a lot of limitations. And if we could look at really what's going on inside the wall, there are additional measures we could look at. For example, look at the velocity of each little piece of myocardium that's moving around in space, ideally in three dimensions, or at least the displacement. And the displacement as a function of time could be differentiated to get you the velocity, or sort of go back and forth between these. Or if we look at the motion between pairs of individual little particles, we could look at strain. How are they stretching? Is it contracting? And so, for example, as the heart's going through its cardiac cycle, it's contracting in its circumferential, shortening in the longitudinal direction, and thickening in the radial direction. Okay, it's a tensor property. So we'd like to get this kind of information, ideally, to really characterize the motion. Now, we have issues then. What do we do with this data, as I said, when we generate it? And either we can sort of qualitatively, as I said, we just sort of look at these cine loops in a practical clinical way, sort of look at these raw images bouncing around and say, oh, the heart's moving well, this part here is not moving well, must have some ischemia or whatever. Or radionuclide imaging, for example, typically stack up these bright images of the wall where it's shown the activity, threshold it out, and make a 3D model showing this sort of bulging area that's coming out, perhaps an area that's not contracting well, and say, gee, that matches well with this poor area of uptake. We'd really like to do this in a more quantitative way. Despite the fact the eye is very good at extracting things from these dynamic displays, it still has limitations. In the radionuclide imaging business, we use these so-called bullseye plots, typically. We'll say have a series of cross-sectional images that we're going from the base to the apex in the short axis plane, and sort of schematically putting those as concentric rings, like in a bullseye target. We can then, say, color code around different angular sectors, comparing, for example, the anterior wall to the lateral wall, and say, is this thickening up normally, or whichever kind of indication. Then we could compare that, for example, with radionuclide uptake and try to look for areas of match or mismatch, for example, with stunning or something like that. Now, we can also take our raw images and overlay on them. For example, if we can derive vectors, for example, or displacements as a function of time. We put these little overlays on or color code areas that are moving well or not. Or we can just create pure functional images using derived variables related to motion and show those spatial distribution of the values of those variables. Now, it all sounds great, but there are limitations. What limitations? Well, spatial limitation of resolution as well as spatial sampling is always a problem. And again, being no free lunch, the higher we want to push the resolution, the longer it's going to take to get the data. And the patient may not be willing to lie there for 5 hours. So we have in-plane resolution, which is often different than the slice thickness. So the in-plane resolution of an MR system is typically a little larger than a millimeter or so in the in-plane, but the slice thickness may be, you know, 6 millimeters or 8 millimeters. So there's a really anisotropic kind of resolution typically, for example, in MR. Now CT is currently the leader in spatial resolution, where typically we're getting sub-millimeter resolution and isotropically with sort of pretty much standard off-the-shelf machines in most places now. And this is then going to be followed by MR and echo. Echocardiography, again, is limited. If we go through the chest, the wall, the usual way of doing, we really have not great imaging. If you go have the patient swallow a large endoscope and put a transducer right behind the heart, looking through the esophageal wall, we can get a lot higher resolution. And there's still limitations to what we can do, and that's obviously not something we'd like to do on a routine basis. We can get the information other ways. Temporal resolution, again, resolution is slightly distinct from sampling. We'll talk about both, really. And this comes in two flavors. You know, the cardiac cycle phases. How many pieces can we divide the cardiac cycle up into? Is it like, just, you know, 5 chunks across systole, or can we really look at it more finely than that? And although much of the cardiac cycle things aren't moving terribly rapidly, there are some relatively rapid phases, like early filling in the beginning of diastole, can be quite rapid motion, And that's a very important indicator, for example, of diastolic dysfunction or early development of failure. That probably slows down a bit. It's going to be nice to really define that. In order to get that high resolution, you sort of have to get the whole cardiac cycle divided up. Another issue is with MR imaging, though we have these very pretty pictures, typically those pictures derive from multiple cardiac cycles, which then pool the data and reconstruct sort of an effective average cardiac cycle, which is fine if the heart is going back to the same place each time. If somebody's in an arrhythmia, for example, they've got atrial fibrillation, the interval of filling changes from beat to beat, we're not going to have some reproducible geometry, and this may not be quite so sharp. We also have the issue, how much data can you get in a breath hold? You know, people can hold their breath, you know, comfortably probably for 15 seconds or so. Some people can hold their breath for half a minute or longer. The heart rate tends to change during that time. But other people, so for example, get stiff lungs from a failure, probably don't like holding your breath more than about 10 seconds. So this really sets a limit on how much data you can get. So you can try saying, well, let's dual gait, synchronize with the heartbeat and respiratory phase. But then that, depending on your duty cycle, it gets longer and longer. So you point in the same situation of how much data can you take before the patient starts squirming, in which case you've lost anyway. So these are sort of ongoing active issues, how to do that. So various methods such as parallel imaging, particularly higher fields where you've got a little more data than noise to play with, are promising, but there are limitations still. Now with spatial resolution, another issue is we have spatial registration. You can have a very sharp image, but if it's lined up with the next image that's offset by half a centimeter, then it's not clear what you really gain in terms of trying to reconstruct the full 3D structure. One advantage of these newer CT acquisitions is you're really getting a whole 3D set in one breath hold. Again, it's cardiac synchronized for the gating, but at least you don't have this issue of trying to piece together different splices that are required of independently held breaths, which is the case when you with both MR imaging. As Matt said, you could take a hit in spatial resolution and try to get all the data for volume and breath hold, but typically the registration is going to the expense of resolution in both temporal and or spatial. Finally, I'm going to expand on these issues. Point correspondence and through-plane motion can also significantly affect things. So, what's the point correspondence problem? Sounds like a mathematical way to phrase things. And here, as we've said, when we look at those images, you can't tell one part of the heart wall from another. It all looks gray. And there's no real fiducial marks there. You have joints between the right and left ventricles, for example, which provide a point to follow. But anything inside the wall really cannot be followed. So how do we get around that? Well, with echocardiography, there's a couple of approaches which are being explored in recent years. One is the kind of Doppler effects, the frequency shifts which have been used for decades to really to look at blood flow within the heart, can also be applied to looking at the wall motion itself. So even though the excursions are relatively small and low velocity, if you sort of tune up your sensitization, you can actually measure velocity. Now you're limited to the velocity component along the line of sight, the line of hearing, I guess, with ultrasound. And so that's not a really great sampling. So you have to say, well, at some points I'm sort of lined up along, looking down the barrel of the septum from the apex, for example, I've got a sample for longitudinal motion. Then somewhere else, maybe I'm looking at a short axis view, I've got a motion circumferentially. But you can't really choose what layer you're going to look at. So it's useful, it's promising, but it's limited. Another approach to take with echocardiography is to use so-called speckle tracking. Now, if you look at an echo image, I thought Matt would be showing you some that I said in Brooklyn here, but what you see is you see structure, and the structure seems to move with the heart. But that structure is not real heart structure. It's rather coherent speckle. It's a sort of the interference between the ensemble, little scatters within the wall, produces a macroscopic pattern of modeling in the image, which is just, as I said, coherent interference, just like if you ever looked at a laser spot projected on the wall, it has a swarming pattern of dots, same kind of coherent structure, which is not real structure. It moves roughly with the heart, but it's not the same. So it's useful, and can be done very quickly, which is cross-correlation of one frame to the next, sort of say where things are moving to. But it's not perfect. But at least it gives you sort of something that can supplement the Doppler approaches. Now, with MRI, we have sort of analogous kinds of things. As was shown you already, we can do so-called tagging techniques, where we can actually create synthetic but real fiducial marks within the wall by locally perturbing the magnetization in ways that show up in the images and move the underlying tissue. There's also sort of the analogy to Doppler imaging and velocity imaging, where we can use phase shifts in the image to actually tell us about the local velocity for short times or displacement for long time frame intervals. And the phase information is in the images. We just sort of throw it away conventionally and only show you the magnitude. We can take advantage of that with modified imaging techniques. So here's just schematically the principle of doing the tagging. If we have, this little black frame is meant to schematically indicate our image plane. If we can create a set of parallel planes of altered magnetization perpendicular to that, where they intersect, it shows up as these little lines. You can do a couple of families and make a grid this way. And in particular, as there's a short axis and long axis, and as the heart contracts, because that's in the magnetization, those planes will move, and thus corresponding lines of intersection will move. So here, for example, these are images are relatively high resolution, though quite old, and required with respiratory and cardiac gating. So here, a short axis and a long axis going through systole, we can see quite dramatically that we have motion, which is a combination of rotational and translation of motion. The initially square grid becomes quite deformed. We can see here the same thing in systole and in the long axis. And we can even look at differences, for example, the relaxation, the waves of a wave of relaxation runs over the heart. It's not quite synchronized with the apex to base. So there's lots of information in here that you can assess qualitatively. And this is, you know, from a clinician's point of view, easier to read when looking for abnormal function than just trying to look at the untagged images. Once you get a little used to looking at these, you can say, this is really not contracting, but even though it seems to be moving, it's not shortening as it should. Now we can speed things up. This is some work with Dan Kim, who was a postdoc by the name when he was a grad student at UVA, looking at patients in the butamine stress. You have to sort of soup up the imaging a bit to really try to follow this heart. You can see it's the ejection fraction is super normal. The heart is sort of squeezing out more vigorously. It doesn't have a chance to really fill well because it's speeding up as well. But we can actually follow these tags, both the right and the left ventricle, even under maximum to butamine stress. And here, Vinay Pai has been working with me now, sort of pushing things with parallel imaging techniques, and we can really get dozens of phases across systole alone, and a couple hundred phases across the cardiac cycle if you want. Of course, you have the issue, how do you analyze all this data? And as indicated, that's a non-trivial enterprise by itself. But the potential is there to really push the limits on the imaging in terms of higher temporal and spatial resolution. Now here's a low-resolution image, relatively. This is a patient who's in failure, not doing well. But notice we're seeing interesting things now with the tags, even though they're coarse grid. Look at the anteroceptal junction here. As the heart relaxes, it gets a little double bump, we call it. It's relaxing, and another piece of contractor, similarly, the same area here. It's contracting, relaxing, but during the relaxation phase, it squeezes again. And this sort of so-called post-systolic shortening, reported later, you can see it in normal people, is not an uncommon finding we find in failure. I haven't written this up, hope you don't roll radar before me, but it's really interesting, we can see this. And I'll show you later, we can measure this, and it really shows up in the images. So there's a lot of information here, which is really not apparent without the tagging. It's really almost invisible without it. It's also been seen with echo, obviously, but this is a really unique way to really characterize this in three dimensions. Now, another limitation in trying to analyze this data is what's the effect of through-plane motion? This effect we've got tagging, because in general, we have a fixed imaging plane, but the heart is moving in three dimensions, as you're seeing. So it's not only moving in the plane, so in a short axis, it's moving through the plane, being pumped through. Now, because the heart is not a cylinder, it's a cone or a football kind of shape, it's an ellipsoid, this can lead to actually two kinds of errors. First of all, even without tagging, as the heart moves in through the plane, the apparent size of the heart is different as a function of cardiac cycle phase because we've got this fixed imaging plane. So even if you had passive motion pulling the heart through the plane, you have an apparent change in the diameter. So as the base moves towards the apex and during systole, we have apparent widening, which means that we're underestimating the true shortening in the radial direction of the heart during systole. And similarly, if you're looking at wall thickening, the obliquity of the wall is changing as a function of the cardiac cycle phase because it's being pulled through. And so if what was more tapered becomes more straight, again, we're underestimating the true thickening of the heart. These are real systematic errors that we're going to get because of this. Even our conventional sort of the generic CT, MR, or echo imaging. So here's some example. You said with images with tags, they don't have to be tags in this particular case. So here we're looking at a patient, and during systole, we see the base moving towards the apex and moving back again. So this is so-called kind of five-chamber view here with the aortic root, the right ventricle, left ventricle, and the corresponding atria and the aortic root here. You can see at this plane here, what starts off as being in the ventricle, actually starting to pull through into the atria. So let's look at a corresponding short axis view here. Here's the left ventricle, right ventricle outward tract coming up towards the pulmonary valve, being in the aortic root. At the end diastole, when things are out here, we're sort of clearly in the ventricle, right ventricle, left ventricle. We have this nice continuous loop here of the infundibulum. But as we go through into systole, towards the end of systole, we've now pulled the aortic valve plane down into the plane of the image. This so-called supraventricular crest is getting pulled down to the imaging plane. So it looks like we're splitting the RV outflow tract in two. You see the mitral valve here sort of closing nicely here and becoming now an LV outflow up into the aortic roof. So where are you? It depends on which phase of the cardiac cycle you're in. You've got a fixed imaging plane, a moving part. So this really has to be thought of as a three-dimensional structure moving through a space which is sampled at regular intervals with these 2D imaging techniques. And somebody had pointed out that the thickness of the RV wall at the base is obviously apparently changing in funny ways just because it's being pulled through the plane of the image. Now, there are other limitations about the image analysis. As Nat said, there are no, I think I can say that safely, truly robust automated approaches to analysis, even for simple, vanilla things to calculate volumes, let alone these fancy things we're doing with various kinds of strains and so on. Now, the rate-limiting step is a segmentation. As Nat says, he's got somebody who sits there in the lab and does it all day, and that's the ideal situation, because at least they do it consistently. They may not be right, but at least they'll do it the same way consistently, because they're doing it in a routine way to get in the habit, so at least you can compare in a reliable way from time to time. And there, the real problem is saying, where is the edge? And that's the fundamental problem in segmentation. Again, we'll hear more talks about some of these issues later in the week. That's with Dimitri's group. We're working on trying to address this, but it's still an ongoing, very open question. And the tags make it even harder. Now, if you want to track the tags, that's also time-consuming. So we've used things like aggregate contours or snakes, optical flow techniques that Jerry played with, the HARP technique, and we've done some stuff with Gabor filters as kind of the dual of HARP. And phase imaging for this sort of phase contrast analysis motion. In principle, it's faster. You just get a number out. It's a phase. But it also has some limitations. So let's look just a little bit more detail what some of these problems are. So when I first did tagging, I said, you manually sat there and tracked tag intersections and just read them off the screen and entered in my little programmable calculator. That's extremely tedious. It's great to get started, but it's not something you want to do on a routine basis. Now, there are various other techniques that were introduced then quickly. So you said, like cross-correlation. For example, you have a template of what intersection looks like. You sort of map that around, find where the intersections are, and pump that out. Or you can say between successive images, again, sort of these various variations in optical flow, which piece of the next frame matches this particular piece of this frame best, and sort of looking at little search windows around. And, you know, a lot of techniques of this sort, for example, in the particle velocimetry, things like that. Now, deformable contour approaches have been used by Dimitri Tosopoulos' group. He's now down here, I believe. And this has become a very powerful technique in a lot of applications. We've used this for tag tracking, as well as for tracking the edges of the HARP. The HARP technique, as mentioned, is really essentially looking in the Fourier domain, trying to see where the tag pattern is shifting to. So the tags are normally done as a regular space repeating structure, but we can look, they have a corresponding spike in the Fourier domain of the image, so we can look at the corresponding, if the tag shift that results in the corresponding phase shift. And so we can use that as a simple but relatively rapid way of trying to estimate things. Alternatively, in the image domain, we use Gabor filters, I'll show you in a second, which is the sort of the dual way of looking at things, which have other approaches. Now, one key point about all this, we only know where the motion is at the tag, really. So here's just an example from the Tishar Mangalkar group. These are hand-drawn contours, but in terms of where the edges of the LV wall are, but the green lines are totally automatic. These are just, you sort of want them to start the tags at the stripes, these snakes at end diastole when they're nice and parallel, sort of lock them in there, and they just track along and follow because they're being pulled by image forces. And so this speeds up the process of tag tracking remarkably well, as long as you have decent images and with a few appropriate constraints on how you define the forces, this really can work pretty well. With Gabor filtering, this has been used in a lot of other contexts for image analysis applications. And Gabor filters, for those who aren't familiar, basically you can either view it as a sinusoidally modulated Gaussian or a Gaussian windowed sinusoid, depending on how you want to look at it. But they really provide a nice basis for wavelet decomposition of images. And so you can tile sort of Gabor space for the images. But our purpose here, basically we just have a limited set of Gabor filters. And what we're looking for, say this is an idealized kind of sinusoidal tag pattern, which you think about for the heart, we can say at a given location, this stripe here is going to be matched by Gabor filter with it, so it matches here, whereas in this trough, for example, we have an opposite Gabor filter in between, something with a phase halfway between. And so if we use a bank of these filters and sort of cross-correlate them to the image, we can look at the local response. And first of all, we can say whichever is the areas that lit up bright, those are the areas that are tagged. So for example, even though the intensity of the cavity is very similar to the intensity of the untagged myocardium, if we do a Gabor filter and look at the response of the filter bank, only the wall is going to light up, because that's the only part that has tags in it. So it's a way of sort of doing a texture filter in a sense here. In addition, we get position information by the phase of the appropriate Gabor filter element, which responds. And we also get some information about the wavelengths. We get some strain information by the wide modulation or narrow modulation. So it gives us a lot of information, also orientation, because you can throw that in as a variable as well. And so here's in fact the result of just looking at the magnitude of the strongest response, many of the filter bank. And you can see here we sort of got provided a nice, somewhat fuzzy, but well segmented, but now the cavity is dark. It's because we've got this filtering. Now, tag cardiac MRI is still relatively new, and the limitations of the analysis have sort of been the main factor limiting its application. We've already learned a lot of information about the heart, things that were known to some extent from other techniques, but really more detail. First of all, there's a lot of normal variation in the motion around the heart. The free wall moves a lot more than the septum. The apex moves a lot less than the base. The heart has various torsional modes, sort of rings and unrings. And Teo Arts will tell us more about that. There's really been a lot of work on understanding that. A lot of differences in the right ventricle and the left ventricle. The right ventricle moves more than the left ventricle. And all these things are altered in disease. For example, obviously ischemia and infarction moves less, no surprise. We have both local effects and remote effects. So you have an acute infarct, one part's not moving. The rest of the body says, hey, we need more blood up here. Crank up the rest of the heart, and the other heart, rest of the heart, remotely starts beating a lot more. With hypertrophy, and that showed you with pressure overload, we have actually, even though it's normal ejection fraction, decreased contraction on the regional basis. With volume overload, the heart, so-called eccentric hypertrophy, gets larger. And again, this ulceration is the way it's going to contract. Local changes in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Alterations and failure, as I showed you, cardiomyopathies in general. And finally, obviously, conduction abnormalities. One part of the heart contracts a little later than the other. You're going to see that very directly. You know, Fritz will talk some more about some of that perhaps. And again, with pacemaker therapies and for this cardiac resynchronization therapy, for example, for failure, we see corresponding changes in these mental models. I've said that there's some problems potentially with phase analysis. Obviously, phase by itself is varying around the image, so the component of the phase related to motion has to be separated out by having some kind of phase reference, which means you have to take additional data to calibrate that out. Obviously, phase is also ambiguous. We get more than plus or minus 180 degrees. So you travel around the world, you keep going travel a little further, you'll be getting closer to home again. You only have one motion component per imaging acquisition. So we get a velocity measurement or displacement measurement, but if you want to get three space, you have to keep taking that data. Hopefully you can try to pool that phase reference, otherwise you wind up taking lots of extra data. Now in principle, you can measure the phase at each pixel, which will give you the motion at each pixel. But in practice, signal to noise limits, so you actually have to kind of pool the data from a little patch around each pixel, so it's not quite as easy to achieve that in practice. So there are a lot of technical limitations we've alluded to, and there's more. But there's also inherent biological limitations. Some of those were, again, alluded to earlier by Nat, just a lot of individual variability in terms of everybody's different normal. You know, some people are bigger than others, some are male, female, old, young, and so on. But in addition, there are inherent problems even in an individual subject. I pointed out the roughness of the endocardial surface and the fact that roughness scale actually changes with cardiac cycle phase. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. There's also, as was indicated in the first talk, sensitivity to the physiologic state of the patient, you know, the so-called loading conditions, both preload and afterload, that is, the patient's heart's getting filled up well each time, it's going to contract well each time, sort of the Starling law. So on the other hand, if the patient has high resistances trying to force the blood into, it's going to push out less blood, just a simple hydraulics. Now, the problem is we can't really reliably measure this during an examination. Run up to the GCRC and try to measure their pressures quickly, you know, after they've done the IMR sweep, but you know, it's not the same state anymore. And even during the exam, things change. So a typical story is the patient gets into the hospital, they're not feeling well, you know, they go down to MRI, it's the first time I've ever had an MRI exam, they see this big thing with this donut, they get anxious, the heart rate goes up, you know, everything changes. There's different physical exercises, they get in the magnet, settle down, this is not so bad, you know, then bang, 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 and they sort of start getting sleepy, and the heart rate goes down, the resistance goes down. But then they start getting antsy, you know, I've been in here a long time, I don't know what they're finding, you know, my bladder's getting full, I want to get out of here, heart rate goes back up. You know, what is the physiologic state? There is no one physiologic state. It's really very dynamic. Now we compound that, we want to start looking at stress. I showed you butamine stress, for example, and I talked about that. Now in stress, again, you're not settled to a steady state, you're sort of running the butamine in a stepwise kind of way. You know, the situation is continuously evolving, and you can't hold it for very long. And you don't want to load somebody up with the butamine and leave them there. Well, you take a half hour's worth of data, they're just going to spend for it. The IRB won't let you do it. And finally, as Nat said, we don't know what the material properties of the wall are in any individual patient. And in fact, even an individual subject, we're going to take a pig heart, we're going to study the pig and stress them and so on. Say, okay, let's take the heart out. It's not the same heart that you're measuring on some kind of stretcher that you did study in vivo. It's really not in fundamental ways. I also indicated this problem, you know, where is the endocardium? It's like this question. You know, how do you know? Well, we showed you some very pretty pictures, nice bright blood, dark wall. But it's not always that clean. For example, some imaging techniques rely on the blood being flushed in and out. And if you don't have good blood being flushed in and out, for example, an area that's not contracting, the blood actually sort of sits over the top and doesn't move well. So you don't have a good boundary. And with some of our bright blood imaging techniques in high field, we now have very expensive artifacts that can degrade the image quality. So you may not have a good boundary. Plus this sort of quasi-fractal interface, even the ideal situation. You know, it's like, how long is the coastline of Norway? Well, it depends how closely you look at it. You know, longer and longer the closer you look. It's classic. The same thing happens in the heart. It's quasi-fractal, you know, fair range, an order of magnitude. And depending on the cycle phase. And so also this issue, you know, are the papillary muscles part of the wall or part of the cavity? I mean, obviously, they're not part of the wall because they don't have enough blood to move in and out. But on the other hand, you know, they, not, they sort of stick out there. Convention has been to whack them off and treat them as part of the cavity. But then where do you whack them off? Depending on the cardiac cycle phase. So here's what the inside of the heart looks like. This is some data we looked at from CT. So the CT is getting pretty darn good. We can look at it two ways. Either there's a cast of the endocardium. This is a live heart, just, you know, with magic of image processing. And we can see, since the atrium is quite smooth, is the mitral valve plane. But then we look here at this really kind of corrugated surface of the blood towards the systole. And now if you look from the inside out, now making the blood transparent, the wall opaque, because here's a papillary muscle, here's another papillary muscle. You can see here there's a lot of rough stuff going on. It's a little smoother on the septum here. But it's hardly what you call really well-defined simple surface. Looking again here. In fact, if you look and cut this in cross-section, made some observations, every anatomy book shows the papillary muscle being solidly attached to the wall. In fact, it's not. These little root things that break up actually go all the way underneath. They're under, it's like, you know, the pier from the piles or a mangrove tree in the swamp. And the blood just sort of sloshes all the way into the base. And you can see if you do a little cutaway here, that it's not a solid attachment. So in that sense, it sort of makes sense to keep it as part of the cavity. But as the heart contracts, the blood gets squeezed out there, you lose that sort of plane. It's not really a plane. Way to cut it off. So it's not a simple problem. Now, if you want to assess the function of the heart, we have to do it in the context of, you know, what's its response to stress often. Because people are often not so bad if they're just lying there quietly, nobody's stressing them, they sort of adjusted to lying in the magnet, gotten used to the idea. But that's not what people live. People have to go out, you know, sort of go climb stairs, try to run, catch a bus, pick up babies and carry them around, whatever. And that's when they start having symptoms. And so we have to somehow reproduce that in the magnet to assess their functional reserve. Make a perfectly normal measurement to the line there quietly on stress, You want to know what's the reserve to really know what the function is. So how do you do that? Well, I mean, real life, it's exercise. But if you try to exercise in the magnet, people have actually done this with some MR-compatible ergometer devices and so on you can lie on your back and use. It's not so simple. You know, the heart rate goes up. You start, breast rate goes up. Increased respiratory excursion, and they move around during their pumping activities. So you're not going to get great pictures. And the heart rate going up, mostly it's going to come out through shortening of the diastole. But as the heart, you do increase your contractility. You maybe decrease your vascular resistance. A lot of things are going on. You have to sort out which is doing what to the heart. Now, in radionuclide imaging, for example, and in echo, for example, use stressing with other agents, vasodilator, inotropes, sort of real life exercise. We do both those things, but appropriate drugs, we can decrease vascular resistance in the coronary bed to increase the flow. If you have poor circulation in a given area, that'll make a steal often, so decrease the flow to an affected area may decrease its motion. Or with dobutamine, as I heard, you can sort of flog the heart, make it contract harder, go faster, and that'll help bring out areas of poor reserve. You're sort of already doing the best you can't do any more. So often also decrease heart volume, as I showed you earlier. So put the patient in, we've got all these fancy imaging techniques, we're flogging them, we're doing all sorts of stresses. What are we going to do with this data? Well, let's assume we can extract it. And there's a lot of different things potentially to do, well beyond an ejection fraction or even an end-diastolic volume. First of all, we can try taking data from multiple planes, as I mentioned, reconstructing the full three-dimensional motion, even though we're doing two-dimensional imaging. This is, again, assuming the patient's more of the same physical states, where our different samples refer to the same heart. And then from that, we can then try to reconstruct, for example, displacement of velocity vectors, looking at torsional modes, we can look at rigid body motion by itself, which is basically translation and rotation, and that can be separated out, given this appropriate displacement field, from the underlying strains and deformations we were talking about. And then given all this, we can try to estimate, given huge amounts of uncertainties, corresponding stresses within the wall. So let's just first look at this issue. How do we take our two-dimensional images and turn them into three-dimensional motion? As I said, we really only have information where we've measured it. So if we're looking at tagged information, we only have information where the tags are, strictly speaking. We just assume that things are behaving smoothly between there. There are various ways of trying to fill in the gaps, as it were. We can use finite element methods, which in effect are using splines, and people then vice versa. Two- and three-dimensional spline techniques, so the free-form deformation approaches. These various ways of trying to detect the tags with the Hart or Gabor techniques, in effect, allow us to interpolate between what is actually observed, but really, strictly speaking, we only have information where the tags are. As is mentioned, this through-plane motion is really going to affect our two-dimensional images. So we really have to think of things in a three-dimensional context to fully understand them. So in order to do that, we can try combining multiple data. But again, this depends on having the data be spatially registered. Now, to some extent, we can push the data around and see, well, this heart is still up here, it's down here, and the next one up. It's a little stack of coins. So just as you have a little stack of poker chips, you can sort of realign them. Same thing, to some extent, with the heart, but only to some extent. And finally, if we're going to look at things over a cardiac cycle, we can say, well, this has to behave in some reasonable way over time, so we can do some amount of temporal filtering just to try to correct for some of the little glitches that might otherwise creep in with individual uncorrelated analyses. Here's just some work we've been doing, just trying to use some spline interpolation. Here we've got some tag data. We've got tags have been extracted where these red lines are, and now we can do a simple kind of interpolation of the splines. And so if a family of splines is behaved smoothly between the place where we have constraints. In order to carry that out, you have to say, what do I do in between here? I've got a spline here and a spline here. And so you have to do some extrapolation, which is inherently uncertain, but at least it provides a reasonable way of trying to get a dense estimation of the motion, say, this component here, corresponding orthogonal family of tags, then we can get a dense estimation of the motion in the plane. Now, when we've reconstructed the motion, we now have this issue of what are we going to display? You can display either the instantaneous motion, so the instantaneous velocity. You can look at the track motion over time. So you have to say, where am I at this moment, or where have I come from? This is the whole path. Now, if you have velocities, you can integrate them to find displacements. So sort of these phase kind of techniques. Or alternatively, you have displacements, you can differentiate and define velocity. And it's just sort of contravariant, covariant tensors in a sense. And this sort of corresponds to so-called Eulerian and Lagrangian pictures of motion. That is, Lagrangian is sort of following little pits of tissue as they're moving around in space. And Eulerian says, at a given point in space, things are flying by in some direction or another at velocities. But in principle, you can go from one to the other. In practice, for tissue, these sort of Lagrangian material-based ways of looking at motion tend to be most useful, whereas for fluids, blood flowing around the cavity, which is also of obvious great interest, the sort of Eulerian pictures tend to be more natural. Now, here's just an example using that sort of spline interpolation on the patient that I showed you earlier with the post-systolic shortening. And you'll see here, this is the extracted, now dense estimation of the vertical and horizontal tags, giving us the corresponding displacements. You can calculate dense strains. We then show these little dihedral icons scattered all over the heart wall. And then we can look at the corresponding evolution, the circumferential strain, the reference frame, so locally what's the circumferential direction, defined having defined where the wall is. We can see here, it shortens, starts to relax, and this is the magnitude of the principal strain here. And again, post-systolic shortening tries to squeeze again as pressure drops in the wall, still a little tension, delayed relaxation, gives them a little squeeze, and then continues to relax the rest of diastole. So it's information we can start extracting for this. It's really hard to get any other way. Now, where does all this go with modeling? So modeling, we've done implicitly a lot of modeling just to get to this point, what we've been talking about. It really provides a lot of potential tools, and we're starting to look at some of these. For example, segmentation. People have looked at, if you have the formal model of a generic ventricle, if you can stick that down to the ventricle and use that to regularize the problem doing segmentation, that can help things, both finding the heart from the cavity, from the surroundings, as well as the cavity within the wall. In terms of doing this kind of registration, stacked up short axis images, they don't quite line up. If you have, again, a regularizing model of what the heart should be doing in between, it can help provide some way of pushing things in some empirical way, at least, back into cleaner registration. Similarly, long and short axis images may have gotten a little bit out of sync. Across the cardiac cycle, we have a model underlying what's happening. We can now relate end diastole and systole in some meaningful way, hopefully. What about patient comes back in serially, or we do rest and stress, serial examinations? How do you relate one piece of the heart to the other? You can only find very limited landmarks. Very hard to find. If you have the model summarizing the modern anatomy of the heart in a reasonable way, you have the ability to register in a more generalized sense across serial examinations. Or finally, you want to provide reference standards. Not just reference standards, but how big is the heart supposed to be in a patient who is this gender, this size, and so on. But also, what is this patch of the heart supposed to be doing? As we said, motion is very different. Pre-wall to septum, apex to base, endo to epi. So how do we reference this piece of the heart to our standard? So you have to do that in a model-based way. With visualization, there's a lot of limitations. Inherently, it's hard. You have a two-dimensional screen, or you're displaying your little paper you want to set publish, and you've got a thick wall structure evolving in time. How do you condense that down? And that's not all, as I said, because what reference frame are you going to use? If you have a centroid of the heart, what centroid? The centroid and diastole, the moving centroid, centroid of the left ventricle, the right ventricle, the whole heart. What wall base, is it, concentric to a radial circumferential longitudinal reference to some center area, or is the angle of the wall relative to some center is going to change? Could it reference it to the local wall as opposed to some generic correlates to rural system, for example? Fiber base, we say, well, fibers tend to have this normal pattern of this, so let's assume people are like everyone else, more or less, and reference it to that. Or in principle, if we could measure fibers directly with diffusion techniques, probably not quite yet in vivo, but again, provide a natural basis for reference. And then how do we put all these different dimensions on that? So it's inherently a problem already. Now we've got scalars. Of course, it's easy. It's a color code. It's a kind of pseudocolor for things like net excursion, rotation angle, speed, time of maximum, or 10% of the maximum, or whatever kind of characteristic times you want. Then we've got vectors, displacement, velocities, accelerations even. And those are now vectors, but then we get to tensors, strain, strain rate, the evolution of strain, or tensor properties. And inherently, how do you even do that in a two-dimensional surface, let alone a thick-walled sphere, or shell of some sort? And finally, how do we wind up defining, incorporating normal values for reference for all of these different properties in a way which we can compare one subject to another, or even the subject to themselves over time? Not simple questions. So modeling, again, can be very useful, potentially. It's a way of, by providing three-dimensional models, you can combine data from different splicing orientations, different imaging modalities, trying to do these complicated structures at the base of the heart as things are pumping through. It's pretty much simpler to think, oh, that's just a three-dimensional RV, which is moving in and out of a plane at the base. It makes it much simpler to think of that. Interactive viewers, you can rotate it around on the screen, display the endocardial surface, mid wall, the epicardial surface properties. They can only do that with really with models. And finally, models allow us to then find summary values. Instead of this huge data set of hundreds of images that with different ways of characterizing those locations, you now can summarize that with things like the characteristic times, magnitudes, eigenvalues, eigenvectors. And that then provides something we can combine with reference data. So models, I think, would be really key for doing this in a useful way. This is some work done by another student some time ago, actually looking at the right ventricle. So we've got a model of two normal subjects looking at the right ventricles, sort of whacking off their base, you know, at the sub-endocardial region, mapping displacement as a function of time through systole. And we see it's not a simple radial contraction, there's a lot of base to apex motion. And so we've got a color coding here, the magnitude of the displacement of the base, we can see it's much larger at the base than at the apex. So there's a huge gradient here for the displacement. You know, if you look at the corresponding least principal strain, that's the greatest shortening. We can see that's much more uniform, the color code. Again, even though it's displaced a lot more, the differential displacement is more uniform. So strain is fairly uniform, not quite uniform. And we can see, and, you know, it also can display these little icons here, the orientation and magnitude of this greatest shortening, which, as you can see, is sort of running roughly along the direction of the fibers, the cardiac fibers, as you'd expect. Now, furthermore, looking at these modeling approaches gives us a lot more useful way of trying to approach the physiology, both normal and disease physiology. And here things are getting sketchier and sketchier in terms of our basis for how we can really make these calculations, but it's better than nothing. And I think it gives us insight, if not absolute confidence in the total numbers we get. So we can try to estimate at least stress-strain relationships. And this is really what goes on. Because when we're observing motion, we have to infer what the corresponding forces are. It's the ability of the heart to generate the force, to pressurize the blood, to push it around, which determines whether or not we're going to live or die and how well we're going to be living. So that's really very important. And so we try to understand then the relationships between underlying structures and the observed function, things like the fibers, corresponding to the sheet structures. How much do they really contribute? How much stress release do they provide, for example, the sheets? And the ischemic dysfunction, you know, how do we relate now the ability of the heart not to contract in the area of an infarct, but the so-called tethering area around it. Electromechanical coupling, conduction abnormalities, as I said, you know, somebody with a bundle branch block obviously is not going to have a well-synchronized heart. But somebody's in failure, the heart is getting stretched, now the conduction starts getting discoordinated. And so can we then try to coordinate our approach to therapy with pacing, for example, to the underlying mapping of abnormalities of polarization, depolarization, repolarization. Of course, not when we put patients in the magnet with conventional pacers once they're in there. So we have this limitations in people, at least for now. Diastolic dysfunction, as we indicated. You can have normal systolic ejection and yet have a poor filling, which can then result in blood backing up, people getting symptomatic from elevated blood pressures in their lungs. And can we evaluate the effects of that in patients? So this is turning out to be really a huge public health problem. So that wasn't realized even, say, a dozen years ago. Remodeling, both deleterious and good remodeling after infarct, for example. The interaction with the right and left ventricles. People with right ventricular failure, why? Because it got a common wall affecting the left ventricle. The left ventricle, the same way, same failure, not only is the blood backing up across through the lungs, but it also has a common wall with the right ventricle. So it's purely dynamic interactions. And with modeling, we can start approaching what those interactions really are. Now, a variety of traditional ways of trying to estimate stress in the heart. Now, the classic was so-called Laplace formulas, like for soap bubbles, where you say, well, the balance, the forces between the pressure differential across the wall and the tension in the wall is very straightforward. If it's a soap bubble, it works well. The heart's not a soap bubble. Approximately, the first order it is. And so you have a tighter curvature for a given pressure difference, you need less tension in the wall. It's a simple sort of force balance. Now, the heart's obviously not a soap bubble. It's not a very healthy heart's not a soap bubble anyway. Aneurysm, maybe, it gets not a bad approximation. So for a thick shell, you know, we distribute the wall tension across the thickness, and there's various formulas, a couple of formulas like jazz, for example, that are widely used. In addition, we can start trying to use finite element approaches to estimate the local stress-strain relations. Now here, to really do this in practice, the heart's not jello, it's not rubber. It has, you know, has grain to it, like, and so there's anisotropic properties. There's residual stresses in the wall. If you take the heart out and you cut it up, it starts to spring open. So there's built-in stresses. We don't really know what they are. But we can try to estimate them at least the best we can. And again, try to incorporate this known dependence on loading, known dependence on the contractility of the heart. Again, not sitting in a jar like a Langendorf prep. It's sitting in neurohumeral influences. So it's not a simple problem. But we do the best we can, at least to get insight, as I say. You know, we have to know what the boundary values are to estimate at least the pressures inside and out. So here's just an example of a student was taking a simple model of the heart and embedding in it the subendocardial and subepicardial fibers. And so you generate active tension along those fibers and let things sort of get pushed around correspondingly. And here, just taking some of that data from A.D. Tabor of the observed strains, then trying to estimate the corresponding stresses, again, assuming pressures inside the cavities that would be normal values. We can look at evolutions, for example, radial circumference and longitudinal stresses in physical units, assuming the best guesses we can get from literature what the material properties are. So it's, again, guesstimate to some extent, but it gets, at least gives us insight. Now, where we'd really like to go from this is taking, you know, yet one more level up and say, can we really understand what's going on, not just at the bulk tissue level, the sort of thing you do, put it in a kind of a stretcher machine to estimate bulk tissue properties, but what's going on really at the cellular, in the subcellular level, where the real action is. Now, this goes both ways. We can try to do a forward model, saying, okay, we generate, for example, tension along the fibers and say, what kind of motion are we going to get? On the other hand, we can try to run it backwards and say, given this kind of motion, what kind of stresses are we likely to have at that level? And this is obviously going to be important because that's probably what's driving signal transduction at the cellular level. For example, in pressure overload, we get this concentric hypertrophy where the muscle cells are getting fatter and fatter, whereas in volume overload, they're getting longer and longer. Same number of cells, but different shapes, resulting in different shape of the heart. In infarcts, you have infarct-related remodeling. The heart's not working well here. The rest of the heart tries to pick up the slack to some extent, but at some point, it goes on the wrong sort of branch point, starts getting bigger and bigger and worse. So what's determining that? It's probably happening at this level if we can understand what's happening in the stresses and strains, whatever the magic, you know, things going on at the cellular level causing visual cascades of regulation, that should help us design better ways to treat people. And for example, surgical approaches where we try using remodeling the geometry for big infarct, let's take a tuck and reduce the area of the heart, which where it's not contracting, so it's sort of dead space, and decrease the radius and get us back in the right part of the Laplace tendons. We're putting constraints around the heart to keep it from expanding too much. What's the timing of valve replacement, valve repair? As the heart's starting to poop out, you don't want to wait too long because you may not recover fully. But if you go in sooner than you have to, you subject the patient to unnecessary surgery too soon. So what kind of decision making goes on every day? Medical approaches, do one use inotropes in the old days or ACE inhibitors? Want to modify the extracellular matrix and matrix proteinase modulation of some sort, change the loading conditions, salt reduction, whatever. All these are going to really be affecting things at the stress strain level at the cell and below. And that's really where we want to understand this. So there's a huge potential trying to use the modeling approaches to relate all these different scales. So I've covered a lot of territory. Hopefully all these will be topics, at least some will be explored in more depth by our subsequent speakers. But really, just want to summarize, really had a lot of advances in imaging technology, and it's continuing to improve. It's really giving us a much more detailed picture of what's happening inside the heart wall. But in order to really understand this in terms of the underlying functional properties, not just description of where it's moving to, but really understand what's going on, there's a lot of obstacles. And hopefully modeling will provide us both useful tools for understanding how to analyze this data and how to interpret it. Thank you.